Audi.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. For Dom Jolly, travel is in the blood. From a very young age, he had something that in his recent book, The Hezbollah Hiking Club, he describes as a curiously paradoxical existence between a very posh boarding school and a war zone. He dreamt of being a foreign correspondent before becoming a comedian, investigated the world's most unlikely holiday destinations in his travel book, Investigating Dark Tourism, and for his second travel book, travelled the world in search of mythical monsters such as Bigfoot and the Yeti. Not one to do things in any conventional manner, for this episode of the Big Travel Podcast, I'm getting a tour around Oxford in Dom Jolly's car.
We are travelling.
But we're in a car and we're travelling. The problem is we're travelling through Oxford, not Botswana or somewhere that was exciting.
I feel a bit like I'm with James Corden.
Thanks. Well, we're not going to be singing. We are doing a carpool. Yeah, I can sing, but
can
really
you?
Badly, yeah.
What would you sing if we were doing karaoke right now?
Oh, God, something... I'm a goth, so probably something by The Cure.
You don't look like a goth.
Oh, I was a very big goth. I literally looked more like Robert Smith than Robert Smith for 10 years.
But you grew up in quite a warm country for
a while. I did, but it's one of the weird things about goths is you have goths in England that are Robert Smith, then you have every hot country has one goth that stands by the beach melting, looking a bit uncomfortable, and then you have goths in America that are kind of like Marilyn Manson, and the people that did Columbine were goths, supposedly. So I do fit into
great
the goth
role
genre.
Models, really, yeah. Really, really good role yeah. models.
I'm so much a goth that I've always wanted to make a goth documentary because I was a goth and I have no idea why I was a goth. I've seen so many documentaries on punk, but not on goth. And I've even got the name, Young, Dumb and Full of Glum, or
like
That's
it.
Me in the Corner. See?
No spotlights.
No, yeah.
So did you do the makeup and everything like that? The makeup?
Yeah,
and the
badly.
Hair?
That's the joy. I had crimpers. I had eyeliner. I got savagely beaten up in Beirut for being a goth. Which was probably quite a light thing to happen to you in Beirut, but yeah.
Well, because people were, as we were speaking before I press record, getting blown up all around you. So I think Beirut and Lebanon is a place of travel.
It is.
Should we start there? As we're taking off, we're not taking off, we're, God, it's a travel journalist.
Well, this is
so
odd, because we're driving into Summertown now in Oxford. And weirdly, when I grew up in Lebanon, I stayed there till I was 7, and then the Civil War started in 75. And I went for 1 year to a Quaker high school above Beirut in a place called Brumana, where I now found out I was at school with Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
For a year.
I read that.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, he was 16, I was 6. We were there together, and I didn't meet, and I don't remember him. And then after that, I went here to the Dragon School in Oxford. So I spent half my youth in Oxford, which is the kind of quietest, most civilised, dull place on earth. And then I'd go back to Beirut, which to me was so exciting and amazing. So that's given me my slightly schizophrenic.
But it was exciting and amazing. It was a war zone.
It was a war zone, but like all those. Well, of course, they're going to stop. It's a red light. Jesus Christ.
Do they recognise you, maybe?
What?
Does that 10-year-old boy recognise you?
I don't know. Should we have a bit of road rage?
Yeah.
Well, stop telling people to stop at red lights. It's pretty obvious. Right, we're off already.
Bit of road rage.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, but it was a war zone, so it sounds exciting.
Well, it was, and actually it's what my new book, which I'm not doing that to plug it, but it is what my new book's about. I've kind of milked growing up in Lebanon for so long, because when I grew up in Lebanon, it was very terrifying. 75 to 76 was a proper civil war, and there were periods where, you know, we had to leave by boat to Cyprus because we couldn't get over the Green Line to Beirut. I'd be at school and we'd be being shelled, or we'd be in the basement of our house and, you know, shells landed in the garden and stuff. But it was the most amazing, and still is the most amazing country I've ever lived in. And we were half an hour to the beach, an hour to the ski slopes, the best food in the world. The Lebanese are just fantastic. So I kind of feel I've milked... I mean, it's weird. I know that it was a really dangerous and weird place to live, but it was also incredibly enjoyable, and I've never enjoyed living anywhere else more. So my book is more about saying, you know what, even though I've called it the Hezbollah Hiking Club, it's a love letter to Lebanon. You know, Lebanon is an extraordinary country, especially now.
I've always wanted to go, and
have
every
you not
time,
been?
No, I haven't been, and every time I've almost gone,
yeah.
something's happened to
yeah.
like put me off. And now I've got very young children, and it doesn't. I don't know.
But it's
like
kind of the thing I loved about Lebanon is the fact that you could go there, have the best holiday ever, come back, everyone go, oh, you're in Lebanon, that's a bit dangerous. And you go, yeah, but I'm kind of tough. I'm, you know, really, I don't see danger, me. And also, there'd be no one there. You'd go to somewhere like Baalbek, which is the literally the biggest Roman complex of temples in the world, and you'd be the only person there. And I think I've got to an age now where I think, actually, that's Lebanon's problem. Is it's great for me to be selfish about it and no one goes there, but it's because no one's writing anything good about Lebanon, and it's actually the place you should be travelling to right now. I mean, it's within its size, which is, you know, everywhere is measured by the size of Wales, but it is, you know, I think...
or football pitches or buses.
Yeah, it's the quarter the size of Wales. It's topographically the most different place I've ever been to, apart from maybe Morocco. It's like... everything, just every valley changes, and it's got amazing mountains, the beach, it's got incredible cities, the food is incredible. If you're into politics and history like I am, well, literally everyone is anyone has fought there, you know.
I was watching that, you did a nice little video that accompanied your...
On my iPhone.
On your iPhone.
How amazing are iPhones?
Well,
now?
Yeah, really, very, yeah. Very good.
Thank
and
you.
It was documenting your the journey that you...
Well, it was
about.
Really for journalists who... decide to interview me the day before, and I know they're not going to have time to read my book.
this is me.
No, but also I just wanted to film it because the one thing you can't get across to people in Lebanon, people still think always when you say Lebanon, they think Middle East, they think desert, they think camels, you know, they think the usual cliches. And Lebanon looks like the south of France.
Well, I was going to say Switzerland, and in my head I'm thinking, wow, that looks like Switzerland. And as I was watching the video, he says, look, it's just like Switzerland. I was like, bingo, that's almost like one of those...
That's where I went to school.
Is that your school?
No, that's where I went to school, just down there, yeah.
Oh.
But, well, it was. It used to be Beirut. Lebanon used to be known as the Switzerland of the Middle East.
And Beirut was the Paris of the
yeah,
Middle East.
Yeah. I mean, personally speaking, I don't want to go to Switzerland. It's a kind of pretty
dull,
boring place.
And
Jolly, my name, comes
has
from
Switzerland.
Yeah, it comes from Switzerland.
Does so it? But why is that then? What's the Swiss connection?
Well, my great, 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 great grandfather was from a place called Moudon above Lausanne, and they were Huguenots, and they ended up in the east end of London in about 1650. Because they were persecuted, and then I think someone did something a bit dodgy, and so they had to leave England, and they ended up... I had three generations living in Smyrna in Turkey, and then one of them left and ended up in Beirut. So we kind of slowly ended up in Beirut
from London, though. That's
from London.
And then you
yeah,
made
yeah, yeah.
The way
yeah.
back. Have you done it? Who do you think you are?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you'd be amazing.
I know, but one of the problems with Who Do You Think They Are is they like you to know nothing about your past.
Yeah, I always
and actually
think that.
I don't know too much. There's so much more to discover, but I think I know just too much. And also, I'm not famous enough anymore, so
no,
I need
are.
To go back up again, so we'll see what happens.
So I think that's quite a good place to pick up on, is the Hezbollah hiking club. Yeah.
Which everyone in Lebanon hates that I've called it that.
Oh, no, they can take the joke.
No, they can't.
Well, not the joke, but...
But they can't, because they're all like, no, you've done it again. Like, you know, there's a picture of me with a bullet hole in the front, and that is a picture I took there, because we were walking through this beautiful village, and suddenly I find this shot-up bus at the side of the road, and it's got bullet holes all through the windscreen and through the front seat, little hint of blood, and then just below it on the front of the bonnet it says welcome to Lebanon. And I thought, if a bus summed up the Lebanese sort of weirdness, it's that.
And but there's why have they left it there like that, because this is... I'm sort of jumping forward now, because
yeah.
it's something else I want to talk to you about. But I remember going to Cambodia and Phnom Penh.
Oh, of course, yeah.
S21,
I've been there, yeah.
And
yeah.
they've just... I know, because you wrote a great book that sort of included a lot of those things.
Yeah.
I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself, but
that's right.
Why have they just left it there, like the blood and the, you know, it's not a tourist attraction. They've just sort of walked off and left it. And
well, genuinely, Lebanon has a serious litter problem. So, you know, unless someone's going to pay...
Blood-covered buses and things.
Unless someone's going to pay someone in Lebanon to clear it up, they're not going to clear it up. I mean, it's an unwittingly brilliant tourist destination. But yeah, no, I don't... They just... You know, Lebanon's like that. It's like, well, who's paying me to clear this? And if I'm not, I'm not going to do it.
I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, we're just coming into, like, the beautiful heart of
Oxford. This is the heart of Oxford.
Oxford City as well.
We're near the Bodleian now.
And it's stunning. And this is...
Do you think people think we're making this up? Or actually in a studio just making car noises?
I'll make sure to put some beeps on. And,
well, you got a bit of road rage there. That was good.
Yeah, we've had a bit of road rage.
Well, that was bloody annoying.
I hired those people, by the way,
good.
To come into the studio and give us some pretend road rage.
So we're at the Sheldonian now. Do you know Oxford at all?
Yeah, I've been a few times, yeah. I used to do travel news for Oxford on the radio.
Did you really?
Yeah, but it was all done from London. I was pretending I was here.
Make it up. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I had no idea what I was talking about. But it must have been a contrast coming, you know, living here and then going back to
it was honestly the biggest contrast ever. Like, I remember probably the third night I arrived at the Dragon School, which was, you know, I literally was at school with most of the current Tory cabinet. Radiohead and Tim Henman, and
they're all of the reputation for being wild.
Yeah, they're all crazy people. Yeah. But they all arrived here. So
actually, the Tories are probably the craziest out of the lot of those.
They are. Well, they are now, aren't they? So we're outside Balliol, and I'm doing a U-turn. But anyway, so I turned out, and on the third night in my dorm, I did what everyone does in Beirut. If you're at school in Beirut, you collected shrapnel, which I did. And you collected shrapnel and bits of bullets. And I had a little suitcase that I'd brought with me thinking,
Full of shrapnel.
You know, this is going to make me quite of a big player at school. Because it would, and you know, I had quite a good collection. And on the third night, I flipped open my little briefcase and started showing people in the dorm. And one of them went off running and told the housemaster. Anyway, I was caned for having it, and it was confiscated. And I thought, right, this is a very different sort of place. In Lebanon, I'd have been, you know, worshipped for having this amazing collection of war paraphernalia. Whereas here it didn't. So it was different rules. But my what I did in the holiday essay was much better than most, because most of them was went to pony club, you know, met uncle who was foreign secretary. For me, it was like, you know, went into the Syrian desert, went to Palmyra, spent some time in a basement. You know, it was great.
And Syria is another place that is just, you know, I feel
Syria's
my heart
favorite country. Syria is my favorite country on earth. When people ask me, what is your favorite country on earth? And I'm not doing just to be contrary.
Saves me from doing that.
It's Syria. I mean, yeah. I love Syria. We used to go to Syria to get away from the war. And my dad was a sort of amateur archaeologist, and we'd go to Damascus, and then we'd go to Palmyra, which is my favorite place on earth.
I'm loving your correct pronunciation, because I would have probably said Palmyra.
Everyone says Palmyra. It's my two things I hate the most. Palmyra, and people go Homs. It's Homs. But maybe I'm wrong. I say Damascus, not Damascus.
I reckon you're probably right.
So I don't know if I'm right, but it's what I grew up with, so I'm sticking with it. But I love Syria. Syria is, and that, it just broke my heart. But then I grew up in Lebanon, so now you've got a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon, so everything's inverted, but that's the Middle East.
Well, again, with your recent book about the hiking tour across Lebanon, you saw the Syrian refugee camps.
Well, you can't avoid them. Yeah, I mean, they're big in most towns, and then all the way along the Bekaa, you just have these massive tented villages, and it's just incredibly sad. It's crazy. I mean, Lebanon's a small enough country anyway.
And do you feel like visiting them, or can you not? You know, because you do see people.
Oh, you can't just pop in. It's not, even in a dark tourist way, it's not something you can or I would do. Much so I don't like to talk about my charity work. I am an ambassador for Save the Children, and the only reason I am is because they asked me when the Syrian refugee stuff was happening, and I was thinking, well, at least this is something I vaguely know about. So I've been to Zaatari refugee camp, which at the time was this massive camp on the Jordanian-Syrian border. Now I think it's the fourth biggest Syrian town in the world. I mean, it's insane. And it's the people I went to see there 7 years ago are still there, stuck in these camps. So it's
for
crazy.
7 years, stuck
it's
in a
crazy.
Camp
I mean, there
years.
Were kids I met there that have grown up in a refugee camp.
And what are the conditions like?
Well, the conditions for a refugee camp are not bad. But it's still a refugee camp. It's not a place you want to live in. You know, I grew up in Lebanon, where one of the big problems was you had Palestinians living in Palestinian refugee camps, and they were stateless already and growing up in a camp. That's just not a place for a kid to grow up, or anyone to grow up in. And everyone just sort of forgets about it.
And this idea of dark tourism, I think, is very interesting. And you wrote a book about it.
I did. The original, before
the original
Netflix
book.
Stole
yes.
it off me. Yeah.
Did they?
Of course they did. I pitched it to bloody... after I'd written
it.
The book properly.
Bastards.
And I didn't want to do it as a TV show. I really wanted to show that I could write books, and that I wasn't just a celeb on the make for a free holiday. So I wrote a couple of travel books. My first one was The Dark Tourist, and it did really well. And so I did go to Netflix and pitched it as a, right, now I've done the book, let's do the series. And they said, oh, it's really interesting, we'll get back to you. And they never did. And then very strangely, a year and a half later, this program came out called Dark Tourist, not The Dark Tourist. See how different that is?
That is. And there's nothing you can do, is there?
No, and there's nothing I can do about it.
What's this wall going along here that we're...
Oh, I could bullshit now, but
yeah,
I have no idea.
Yeah, you have
no
idea. It looks a bit like a prison, doesn't it?
Well, it's a college, obviously, but which one?
College, prison.
Know. I'm going to call it Fire Access College. No, that's the sign. I don't know.
There's a sign saying private there. It might be. It's a private
I think
college.
It's St. John's.
It's one of the colleges from Oxford University.
Yeah, we're now coming to the High Street, yeah.
You didn't go to Oxford, did you?
No, I failed my interview really badly. My dad went to Oxford, and he was at Oriel. And then, oh, look, this is Longwall Street, so I believe that's the Longwall
College.
And then I failed my...
I see Longwall.
Yeah.
So it took me a minute to work that out.
No, I failed my Oxford interview, and I went to SOAS, School of Oriental African Studies, to do Arabic and politics. And, I kind of wish I hadn't, actually.
What do you wish you'd done instead?
Well, I wish I'd gone somewhere apart from London, because London's just was so not a university experience, because I already lived there.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. I mean, it's the place you go. If you're a diplomat or you're a potential spy, that's where you go, is so as to learn your languages and stuff. God, this is beautiful, isn't it?
It's really beautiful. And it's such a lovely sunny day as
well
for this time of year.
Really good for a podcast. Just imagine if you can, the views we can see.
Well, it is. You'd be surprised. And I'm sure you know this yourself.
Paint a picture with words.
Exactly. We're not doing it, are we? But it's a nice bridge. It's a long wall.
It's not the bridge. It's Magdalen Bridge. We're now crossing Magdalen Bridge.
It's the bridge.
And this is
beautiful. Lots of cyclists.
Lots of cyclists. A lot of Japanese tourists who are bored after a day at Bista Village.
Oh, they did the announcements on the train in Japanese.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
Well, I'm assuming it was Japanese.
No, it is Japanese. It's incredible. That train from Marylebone down to Oxford Parkway is the Bista Village Express.
I'm quite fond of a bit of Bista Village.
Are you?
Yeah, I don't mind it.
I think it's the worst thing on God's earth.
Well, I've only been twice, so it's not as bad as, like, say, you know, the Tolseng prison and all these the places you visited for dark tourists.
The dark tourist I went to.
The dark tourist, sorry.
So, you know, the doctor. I think that came because I realised that I wasn't really. I love travelling, but I'm just really bad at lying on a beach, or just I can't do normal travel. And part of me is, I think, because I grew up in Lebanon, I was obsessed with these places that were also supposed to be incredibly dangerous when Lebanon was happening in the 70s, the main one being Cambodia, when the Lebanese civil war was happening, the Khmer Rouge was happening, and the whole Cambodian experiment was going on. And I always used to think, I wonder, is Cambodia as bad as I think it is? Is it just the killing fields, or does it, like Lebanon, have actually a really nice part of it that you never hear about because it's not interesting for the news? And I went there, and it was fascinating. It had so many similarities to Lebanon, especially because they were both French colonies and they had the same sort of architecture. But the weirdest thing about Cambodia was that there was a whole generation just gone. If you saw anyone when I was travelling there between the age of about 30 and 60, you're thinking, well, how come you're not dead?
Yeah.
If you weren't dead, that meant you were probably part of the Khmer Rouge.
Absolutely.
It was very weird, because they distrusted all intellectuals, and
they distrusted everyone. It started off with the intellectuals, and the end, it was like, if you were wearing glasses,
anyone. If you liked milk.
Yeah, exactly. But I went there, and it was actually probably the only place that I got... When I was there, I got obsessed with reading about it.
Oh, you know, did you read The Bridge?
Yes, I
did. The most amazing thing.
It's the most amazing
thing. So my most amazing moment where I fell into being a good travel writer was I just went thinking, yeah, I'm going to experience it, and I read all those books, I'm sure you did, and I read the book called The Bridge, and in it there's a particularly awful member of the Khmer Rouge, whose name I forget now, but he was the most brutal of them all, smashing babies against trees and stuff like that. And as I finished the book and I was getting to Phnom Penh, I found out there was a war crimes trial going on, and it was this guy. And I managed to get into the... I mean, I couldn't believe I got in. I thought, how do you get into a war crimes trial? Do you have to pre-book? Do you have to go on StubHub or whatever? But I found out it was there, and I got there, and I was wearing shorts, and they wouldn't let me into the war crimes trial because I was wearing shorts. So I had to swap shorts with the trousers of the Cambodian guard, who was about 4 foot tall.
I was going to say, they
so they were shorts
not
anyway.
Not very tall, yeah.
So anyway, I got in, and I had this incredible Adolf Eichmann moment of kind of reading about this guy who was pure evil. And then you saw him, and he was just this really dull-looking, like, he was an accountancy clerk or something. And there was a moment where he turned around, and our eyes met. And I'm not milking it. It was like, this is crazy. I mean, this guy was up there with Nazis in the evil he did. And your eyes met. So firstly, you felt, I've really had that connection with history, which I think my travel is about. But also, you just thought, really? You're the guy? Like... And it made you think anyone is capable of that kind of awfulness.
That sort of evil.
Yeah.
So
Adolf Eichmann, when he was kidnapped by the Israelis and taken from, I think it was Argentina, back to Israel, and just sat looking so ordinary, and everyone said it was the banality of evil, and it really was that.
It was the only time I felt fear for no reason whatsoever when I went to Sihanoukville, you know, the beach
I didn't
area.
Go to Sihanoukville, that's one bit I didn't do. Why did you
apparently
feel fear?
Apparently it's really changed now, but it was still quite you know, sparsely built when I was there. Apparently it's like, you know, sort of...
Now it's the new Thailand.
Apparently But I went to... There was a hotel that had just opened, the Independent, spelt wrongly, and they've kept it.
I love that,
And it was in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah.
And two very scary moments. One, we were going back on it, and I'd been obsessed with reading about all these books, and I'd been then to the prison and the killing fields and found them very eerie and spine
chilling. It's a weird journey, isn't it?
Very weird. It's a weird thing to do as a tourist on your holiday, you know.
So did you go there to holiday and then got into it, or were you into it before you went?
A bit of both. I went there to holiday. You know, I was lying on a beach for part of it, and it's sort of, you know, the
I mean, it's difficult to go to Cambodia and not. You've got to be a bit. You've got to be a bit dim to go to Cambodia and not take that in.
Definitely,
because it's just so part of every element of that country.
But people are sometimes dim like
that. Oh, I know.
I always
I
think
hate
like
them.
This with Cuba. You know, people that go and lie on a beach in
the
Cuba.
The Kardashians when they went to Cuba. Jesus,
I miss that particular gem of.
I've never missed anything. I watch my history. My dark history is that I watch every bit of trash, and the Kardashians will miss any interesting part of any country they visit.
You can't just go to Cuba for the beaches, lovely, and say, oh, you know, there's the whole culture and the history and the politics and anything like that. Oh, so we were going through the jungle on this tuk-tuk to the Independent Hotel, and it was just dark and eerie. It was almost like the jungle was closing in on me. I think I might have had something to smoke, to be honest. But you think the tuk-tuk driver, the local, you think, well, he's not scared, so I'm not going to be scared either.
Oh God, that's a terrible mistake.
Then he turned round to us and he said, "Are you scared?" And I went, "Yes." And he said, "So am I." And
Oh my God. I tell you, that's so funny you say that, because that's one of the things I always feel when I used to have a fear of flying.
Yes.
I used to think, well, you know what? It's not like the pilot got up this morning and thought, I'm going to die today. If he's okay, he's okay. And then you read about suicidal pilots whose wives have broken up with them and they fly into a mountain. Or when I went to Chernobyl, before it was fashionable.
It's very trendy now to go to Chernobyl.
God, it's crazy, But when I went to Chernobyl and I was like, well, I should have done some research on this. I don't know what type of radiation there was or whatever. And then I figured, well, actually, if someone's going to offer to take me in there, and he's a local, he must know about it.
Yeah, but then you turn
halfway on the trip, I realised the guy was so dim that he had no idea whatsoever. And his only safety thing was, you have had children? I go, yeah. He goes, okay, it's not a problem.
Right.
It wasn't great.
Well, it's kind of like to live to see them, into their teens at least.
When I went to Chernobyl, the weirdest thing for me is I'd read about it a lot because it was a big thing when I was growing up. It was my first sort of post-Lebanon geopolitical worry, you know, like on the news every day you'd hear this cloud is coming and it's a riot, acid rain is falling in Sweden, and it was that whole nuclear nightmare that we're all going to die. And then when
what
I
was
went
the cartoon
when the wind blows,
Raymond
Briggs, who also did Snowman, you know, so
did he do Fungus the Bogeyman?
He did
well.
Do Fungus the Bogeyman, so he went dark on When the Wind Blows. When the Wind Blows freaked me out. I mean, it was really nihilistic and horrible. But when I went to Chernobyl, it was really odd. I thought I was wandering around. I thought, this is so weird. I kind of know my way around. Have I really read so much about this place that I know it? And I got to the stage where I was like, is that the swimming pool? And the guide was like, how do you know? And I suddenly realized I'd been playing Call of Duty a lot. And on Call of Duty 3, I think, they've mapped the place, the town right next to Chernobyl so well that I knew my way around. And of course, they were incredibly suspicious and thought I was some, I don't know what kind of spy they thought I was, but I'm always taken as some sort of spy.
See, it is educational then. Video games are educational.
Well, now I'm trying to get my kid, my 14-year-old boy, off Call of Duty. And he goes, but it helped you with your travels. And of course, that bastard's just won £1 million playing Fortnite.
Yeah, that doesn't
So
help,
now he's
does
like,
it?
If I was an Olympic athlete, you would not stop me. So, yeah, it's terrible.
But you're sitting in your room. But you might get $1 million.
Yeah. We've just driven past a massive mosque.
What was
in
that? Was it a mosque? I was wondering.
It was a massive mosque,
I was going to ask you about it, but then I thought you don't know about that.
I didn't know the long wall.
You didn't know the big
wall.
You're a great tour guide. What are we going to sing?
I could have lied. I hate tour guides, though. I mean, my hatred is tour guides. Like, I feel. My mum always used to say to me, and she was a snob, but she always used to say, we're not tourists, we're travellers.
Oh, yes,
so I've always had this. And I get that. Like, I hate the idea that why would you come somewhere interesting and then just want to walk around in a massive group of people following someone with an umbrella.
Yeah,
I hate that kind of tourism. But it means that also in my travel books, I'm always massively uninformed because I refuse to take a guide. Because I go, I don't need a guide, I'll discover everything myself. And sometimes it's great to have a guide, as long as it's the right guy who, like, you know.
I like a guidebook. I'm a big fan of A Lonely Planet.
You see, I have an issue with The Lonely Planet. I love The Lonely Planet, but for instance, I lived in Prague in 1991. I was a diplomat of all things. And he turned up there and you realise that if you follow The Lonely Planet, you know, Lonely Planet's deal was to say there's a very nice offbeat restaurant. But every single person that read The Lonely Planet would be in that restaurant. So it would be a good way to meet your fellow travellers. But it's not really a good way of making your own journey into a place because you're following The Lonely Planet.
This is what Instagram is doing to travel.
It's exactly
now, isn't it?
That. Mm. It's the TripAdvisor thing. So, yeah, but I love rough guides, actually. I love the concept of the Rough Guide. I did interrailing when I was 18, 87 or whatever.
Oh, lucky you. I wanted to do it but could never get the cash together. I've done it since.
But it was cheap as chips.
I know, but then you had to leave work and, you know.
Oh, okay. Like that, yeah. Oh, we couldn't do it when you were working, but this was like just left school.
So your next book after The Dark Tourist was another travel book, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, which the first email I got about it was someone going, oh, you know that's the name of a David Bowie album and you're just nicking off him. I go, yeah, because people will come to that book and think, oh, is this a new David Bowie book? I was like, of course it's fucking David Bowie's name. I love David Bowie.
That was the whole point of
That was the point of
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, so the idea of that was I kind of, the first book I ever properly read wasn't really a book and it was here in Oxford. This is so good that we're doing this in Oxford, because actually this is where my travel stuff started.
We've gone to the sort of grimmer side of Oxford.
Well, yeah,
now,
because we kept getting into one-way systems and I thought we'd end up getting arrested.
We're in the old the sort of Pizza Hut takeaway.
Well, to me, if you're a tourist place, you'd be in the Oxford where we were, but as a traveller, this
you'd
is where
here.
You come in Oxford, yeah, to see the Co-op.
The Co-op
the
is
Pizza
amazing.
The Pizza Hut deliver, the Mediterranean fish bar, all of life is
I
here.
I bet they do great fish and chips there.
All right, let's just pretend we're still driving through the middle.
The Betfred, you can't go wrong with the Betfred. There's always a betting shop, isn't there?
So when I was here in Oxford...
Hang on, there's a Threshers.
Yeah,
I thought they closed down.
No.
Didn't they? I haven't seen this for years.
Do you not travel outside London?
No, God's sake. I don't even dream of it.
So when I grew up here, I got given for my 8th birthday a book called Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. And it was like Arthur C. Clarke, who I think turned out to be a massive paedophile, unfortunately, and went to live in Sri Lanka for various reasons.
Sunshine, nice food.
And small children. But anyway, that aside, he did do this great TV series where he sort of did lots of these unexplained things. And the thing that really got me was the sort of dodgy Super 8 footage of Bigfoot and pictures of the Loch Ness Monster. And also, I'd been raised on Tintin. In Lebanon, I read nothing but Tintin. I had a map in my bedroom of all the places that Tintin had been to. And I'd said, I'm going to go to all these places when I grow up, and I have now. So Tintin was my big travel inspiration.
Wasn't Tintin a bit racist?
Okay, two bits about Tintin. Firstly, the odd thing is Tintin made me want to travel, but when I eventually did a documentary on Tintin, it turns out that Hergé never left Belgium.
Aha,
never.
Seriously?
But he had a friend, who John Damore, who would go everywhere and send back photos. So everything you read in Tintin, from the posters in China or whatever, is bang on the cars. He had this kind of encyclopedia of images, but he'd never travelled himself. Tintin in the Congo, which is the one you're talking about, which is particularly racist, was an early one because it's dealing with Congo, it's dealing with the Belgian Congo. They were the worst of all colonial masters.
I lived in Belgium for a while. They're a bit odd.
They are odd.
Aren't they?
Well, I love Belgium, personally.
Yeah, I love
it. I think
really
they're cool French.
Yeah.
Everything
yeah.
you think is cool and
Definitely.
French is Belgian.
I was in Antwerp, and that was especially cool.
But I went to the Congo, to this. There's a thing called the Mekele Mbembe, which is a monster that blocks the rivers, apparently, and it was in the north of the Congo. And I went to the Congo thinking, I'm not going to tell them that I'm here because I kind of wanted to go to the Congo because Tintin in the Congo. They love Tintin in the Congo because it defined them as, like, we exist. I've been to French colonies or Belgian colonies that Tintin never wrote about. They're so angry. They make their own fake... I've got a Tintin in Vietnam cover because they want to be done. Having said that, Tintin in the Congo, I remember reading Tintin to my kids, and they loved it all. And I got to the Congo, and they were like, what? I mean, he kills, apart from the racism, he kills 400 animals in that book. There's one where he shoots a rhino, and it bounces off. So he gets on a tree, drills a hole, puts dynamite in it, blows it up. It is the most politically incorrect book in the world.
And also, kids might try and repeat that at home, and that's going to be disastrous.
Not many rhinos in the Cotswolds for me, so I was safe.
There's not many left in the world now, so we're all right, really, isn't
it? But actually, it is a despicable book, but actually, in fairness, he was... Not fairness, but in the same way that Winston Churchill was of his time, the Belgians were a repulsively awful colonial race, and that was their view of it. And actually, to me, it's interesting. I don't think it should be banned, because it actually... Everyone who reads it, who's normal, to me anyway, looks at it and goes, this is insane. And it makes my kids realise there was a time when people felt like
yes.
that. And I think that's much more important than sanitising it and taking the cigarettes out of Tintin's thing. I know that doesn't help. And the Congolese love that. I mean, they love that
book. So educational in two different ways. Educational when you were a kid, encouraging you to travel. And education
but even now,
we can see it through the eyes.
But even I mean, I wasn't a woke kid, but I knew reading Belgian, you know, Tintin in the Congo, that Hergé was not a nicer man as I thought.
You know, I didn't know that reading Enid Blyton. I just sort of you know, absorbed it all in. And it turns out she was a right old racist and sexist and homophobic.
Well, there was a title of one of hers that gave it away, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, there was, actually, yeah.
Which was a big big giveaway.
But
I didn't
read that. No. Growing up with a
Well, it was probably called something else
dad,
as well.
I didn't read that one, I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't realise, was she really that bad? But they were all that bad, frankly, back then.
So did you find any evidence of Bigfoot and monsters?
Okay,
and
so I decided to become a monster hunter because of that, because I love Tintin in Tibet, and I thought, how do you become a monster hunter? And actually, it turns out it's really easy. You just go and get a business card printed that says Dom Jolly Monster Hunter. And you're there. And the best part of being a monster hunter is when you arrive at an airport. So the first place I went, I think, was Vancouver. I was after a thing called Ogopogo, which is Canada's Loch Ness. And they went, and your reason for visiting Canada, sir? And I go, I'm a monster hunter. And they were all going, right, take him to a side room. Like, monster hunters,
rubber
they know you're
on.
Nuts. You really is rubber gloves. But no, I didn't. And one of the problems with monster hunting in itself, if you watch a TV show or a book, is you think, if he has found a monster, we'd probably have heard about it on the news. So he hasn't. So the book was more about the weirdness of those people that get obsessed about trying to find those monsters and stuff. But having said that, there's a lot more into monsters than I thought. You know, if you believe in Bigfoot, you think, well, maybe it's possible. I thought Bigfoot mainly is supposed to be in Northern California. How can you hide something in California? When you go to Northern California, I mean, there's 200 miles of coast called the Lost Coast, where there isn't even a road by it, and it's totally overgrown. So it is possible. California isn't all LA. There is this massive, you know, hidden area. But there's scientific things, like, if you believe in Bigfoot, you have to believe that there's a big enough bunch of them to breed and keep going, so all that stuff. So the most believable one I came to was the Yeti, actually, because I found some Sherpas when I was walking up, quite a few of them, who now all have mobile phones. So when they're walking, they take pictures. And I'd be talking about what I was here for in the Yeti, and they'd talk matter-of-factly about, yes, there was something or whatever. And then they go, oh, in fact, just the other day. So they weren't doing
this.
Got this
on my phone.
No, they did.
And winking and waving,
you know,
from the bush.
But they weren't like, oh, my God, I'm sending this to CNN or something. They were just like, and they sort of flick through and they go, I found this set of weird footprints. Now, whether it is a mythical, you know, who knows what the Yeti is, but, and then the Bigfoot, I found, believe, were the Indians who live up in that area of Northern California, the Hopi, they always talked about a lost tribe of Indians that were these hairy Indians and stuff. I mean, there's more
people
to it than I thought, but the people that always find Bigfoot and go looking for it are always mentalists, including me, probably. But it's good fun.
I imagine,
and also,
on the
when
visa
your kids,
application as well, you know, because sometimes if you put journalist, you're like, oh, I think I might put something
so good.
Else,
well,
know,
I put
like
comedian normally, and that doesn't go down well. But imagine having kids, as I do. It's like, what does your dad do? He dresses as a squirrel. No, you don't want that. He's a dark tourist. He's a what? That's a bit racist. But then you go, he's a monster hunter.
Yeah, my dad was a dark tourist.
Well. Yeah, but he actually was.
He's literally a dark tourist.
So when I say, basically, I'm a monster hunter, finally my kids were like, stay with that. That's so cool. My dad's a monster hunter.
So where else have you been then? Where has you been your best travel experience? One that we haven't covered. Look at that bus. It's bright gold. You've got gold buses here.
Oh, yeah, everything's gold here. Yeah.
Everything. The streets, that the buses streets are paved with gold.
Yeah. We're so happy about Brexit here, I think. That's why.
Oh, is it a Brexity area?
I think it is quite Brexity. Yeah. Actually, Oxford itself in the centre probably isn't, but all the areas around are, yeah, heavy Brexit.
I've been to a lot of areas in the Cotswolds. I've written guidebooks for the Cotswolds for Thomas Cook, yeah, and one to Warwick and one to Stratford and Avon. But there was a lot of Cotswoldy stuff going on there, a lot of cream teas consumed.
Cream teas is always a good guidance to you in a Brexit area.
It is, absolutely, yeah.
Cream teas or people from Kent.
Yeah,
my feeling is
definitely.
You should just give Brexiteers Kent. And they can
cut
have
it
Kent.
Off.
Well, they can
actually
have Kent.
The Isle of Sheppey is sort of.
They can
cut
have
off
Kent,
anyway.
Yeah, Kent and the Isle of Wight, and we'll keep the rest. That's my feeling. This will go down well. Now there'll be a lot of abuse.
No, I don't think so, because I think most people that listen to this podcast
are
travellers.
So we're in Summertown here. Can I give you an interesting fact?
Yeah, Summertown is
right
really
here, which is now Joe's Bar and Grill. In 1976, when I came to the Dragon School here, first place I ever went out to eat was a little place called the Quatre Saisons. And it was Raymond Blanc's first little tiny restaurant.
Seriously?
It's his French brasserie, which literally had red and white checkered tables. And I remember he did a rack of lamb with the little hats on. And that was so exotic in England that time. And from there, he's gone on to Le Manoir or Quatre Saisons or whatever.
But that's really posh. Is that the meal
insane.
That your parents, when they dropped you, dropped you off for school, they took you to a posh restaurant?
Oh, totally. But that wasn't posh in those days. I mean, that it was posh, but it was still like
it's
a little French brasserie.
For 76 to have ribs and little hats.
But I have a theory that
a French name.
I have a theory that Raymond Blanc, he's been here, what, 30 years now, his French accent gets worse and worse. And I think he's actually called Ray White. And when he leaves the studio, he's got a total other life. But anyway, we're going
I was thinking
that.
About the name, actually, and just thinking that in the 70s, I was having a conversation with someone about this the other day, how anything French, you know, how suddenly you had a lounge
A
duvet.
A chaise longue.
A chaise longue and a serviette, because that was a very aspirational middle class, wasn't it? So I imagine the Quatre Saisons was, you know, sort of fitted into that whole sort of...
But to be fair to him, all he was doing was bringing a pretty good brasserie that most French towns had, whereas England just was a culinary disaster zone. It was still Fawlty Towers and what's a Caesar salad and things like that. So it wasn't that posh. It was just posh in the sense that it wasn't a pub, you know. So he did start it off. Now he's possibly gone too far, but discuss.
So where else, what have I missed in terms of your travel experiences? It's so hard, isn't it? Because you've travelled to so many
places. Well, my problem is I'm a travel junkie. I've done, not you're supposed to count, but I've done 93 countries.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's annoying because I want to do 100.
Well, what's left to tick off?
Oh, my God. Okay, so let's talk about where I'd really like to go.
Yeah.
So my absolute number one place I want to go is Algeria.
That's a very interesting one.
And twice I've nearly gone to Algeria and then something's happened there and you haven't been able to get in. And on close to that as well is Leptis Magna in Libya, which are the best Roman ruins in the world. They're in Libya. So those are the two places I really want to go to, I haven't gone to. And Yemen, and an island called Socotra, which is just off Aden, which is this weird island. It's got incredible sort of its own sort of ecosystem and great diving, and I love diving. So those are my sort of three big places I want to go to.
I know you're a big current affairs junkie, aren't you? Because I was showing off to you earlier about my John Simpson.
Yeah,
connection.
Oh my God, I'm so... I mean, John Simpson, to me, when I grew up in Lebanon, the fact that I'm a comedian is insane. I'm not really a comedian anymore. I hope I'm more a travel writer, because comedian wasn't a job. Growing up in Lebanon, the really glamorous things were diplomats, who I now realise are just actually quite dull civil servants nowadays, foreign correspondents, who are just amazing, and sort of travel writers, essentially. So I grew up loving great travel writers and foreign correspondents. So Robert Fisk, loved people like John Simpson, Hugh Pope was someone who used to stay at our place, Jim Muir, like all the Middle East great correspondents used to stay at our house in Lebanon anyway. And I used to think, that's what I want to do. I want to write a great travel book. My parents had a connection with Freya Stark. All these people used to travel, you know, great Arabists and Orientalists and stuff. So that, to me, was what I wanted to be.
Why were they all staying at your house?
Just because we had a really nice house above Beirut, and my dad kind of really ran the family business, but was just into writing and loved writers, and, you know, he was a well-read guy, and he just had loads of connections. So I was really lucky to have, or, you know, John McCarthy was at our place, I think the day before he got kidnapped, and, you know, we were a kind of hub. If you came to Lebanon, you came and had lunch with us. So I was really lucky in that way. My family were living in Smyrna. They were part of the Levant Trading Company, which were these kind of weird little islands within the Ottoman Empire that were like Hong Kong. You know, it was like a tax-free zone, and you went and you had your own rules and stuff. And that's how they ended up there. And they were there for about three generations. And when one of them moved to Beirut, a lot of them were all arrested during the First World War, because obviously the Ottomans sided with the Germans. And they were all moved to this Crusader castle on the Syrian-Turkish border. And they were there for 4 years in this place, and had the Armenian Holocaust going on around them. We're not allowed to call it Holocaust, but the Armenian incidents with the Turks. And so when they got released, my great-granddad wrote a debriefing note of 80 pages for the Foreign Office, which I've just got hold of. So that's going to be my next book, I think, is going from Smyrna across Turkey to this place called Urfa, which is right on the border, and try and find this Crusader castle and stuff.
Do you think you, as because you've got, how old are your kids?
18 and 15.
Oh, that's all right. They don't take much looking after, I'm guessing, she says dismissively with a 7-year-old.
Well, I mean, I've been travelling since I had them, really. And, yeah, my wife left Toronto because she was a Canadian with itchy feet and spent 4 years literally travelling on her own around Japan and all sorts of weird places. Finally gets to England, meets me, thinks time to settle down, and then off I go writing for the Sunday Times and that stuff. But my kids have got my travel bug. I mean, we drove from Cotswolds to Istanbul and back on what all our friends called the big divorce tour. And actually, it was the best holiday we had. We argued less on that holiday than most of that. And my daughter, I taught all the world capitals from the age of two. And she just did it in her... There was some weird exam she had to do. and literally no one else knew the capital. I can't remember what the... it was Madagascar and Tanarivo. And she was so chuffed that I taught it to her. And I was like, yes, I knew it'd be useful one day.
Do you know
day.
What? My mum did that with me.
Did she?
Every now and then it. I get like some tiny African country, the capital like springs into my head. And, you know, if you're in a pub quiz or something and it comes in,
but isn't
like,
it good?
Yes,
it's so essentially useless. But when you know it, you feel so good. It's like, it's amazing.
It is the best.
But she's much more logical than me, my daughter. She's incredibly smart. So she had things like, I'm trying to remember how she remembered it. Capital of Pakistan. Is Lama good? No, is Lama bad?
And
Quito Ador is Ecuador. And like, she had all her ways of remembering it.
It's the best way to do it.
But I love that.
I know what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
Bear Grylls.
Oh, God.
Tell us about that experience. So, is it Celebrity Island, it's called?
No.
What's it called?
It was Minor Celebrity Island.
Next to Major Celebrity Island?
No, it's just called, it was called The Island
the
with
island,
Bear Grylls.
Right.
It's now, the new one, it's called Treasure Island because now they bloody drop... I don't know if you've seen it. The new one's just started.
No.
Now they have the same thing, but they drop boxes of cash from parachutes around the island. So not only have you got people you don't get on with and you're starving and you're unhappy, but occasionally you stumble across a box of 100 grand and you've got to decide whether to share it with the island or obviously keep it yourself. So it's become a much better show.
That's crazy.
Now, Bear Grylls the Island, I did, because I've done a lot of these shows and I can't say no to them, but I can tell you right now that of all the things I've ever done in the world, the hardest thing I've ever done was the island. It was 2 weeks. I did not eat a single thing. I lost 2.5 stone in 14 days. We barely drank. I nearly died. I'll show you a picture later, which will not be great for the podcast, but you can put it on your podcast. And it's my leg where sandflies had buried eggs in it. It was the worst thing I've ever done. But I'm so pleased I lasted it. It's so difficult. Now, Bear Grylls, I always think, when you see someone on telly, I always call them Ronnie Barker or Ronnie Corbett, showing my age. You know whether they're basically good guys or bad guys. Bear Grylls, I've always been in two minds of, because I've met people who've said, you know what, he's a great guy, he knows everyone's name on the crew, he's a bit of a Christian, which is always a bit of a worry for me, a bit of a God botherer. His dad was a Tory minister. And then I've met people, and I've seen things where, you know, he stayed in five-star hotels. There's a classic bit on YouTube where he's hopping around a dangerous lava flow, and then suddenly there's a tourist shooting the same thing, and he's by an interstate. But that's telly, a lot of that. So I met him. We went to Panama, where it's filmed. We spent 2 days being trained by Bear's Marines, and they were really lovely blokes and stuff, and we got quite close to them. And then on the day we're going onto the island, Bear suddenly appears... Bear shirted, because I think it's in his contract he has to take
every
his shirt
time,
off.
Yeah.
It brings the women in, and he's wearing these shades, and he's suddenly there, and we're having our photograph taken with Bear Grylls, and then he's at the wheel of a boat driving us out there looking all macho, and we're like, we hate Bear Grylls, and the crew are going, oh my God, he's going to do the bear prayer, which is apparently before he drops you off into this place, he does a little prayer, and of course it's never shown on telly, and the crew keep going, don't bother with
the bear prayer,
but they do. But just as I thought, what a wanker, I'm sitting there a bit nervous, I'm about to be dropped off. He suddenly sits next to me, he appears like Jesus. And he's like...
Put his top off.
Yeah, he really is. No, he put his top on for me, which was nice.
Damn.
And he goes, Dom, massive Trigger Happy fan. And I'm suddenly like, God, Bear Grylls is such
just
a nice
pulled
bloke.
It back,
yeah.
Pulled it back.
But then when we got on the island, I realised that he'd done that to everyone. Like even, I'm sorry, but Bear Grylls does not watch The Only Way Is Essex. But he was like...
Love
The Only Way Is Essex.
Loved
amazing what you guys do.
Yeah,
really, love the way you just got that, you know. So I don't know.
But that's a technique, isn't it? And that to me smacks of the sort of person I assume he is. And I'm like you, I was in two minds.
He's definitely a business guy.
Exactly. Like, the sort of person that remembers your name all the time
and
uses it.
Which I'm always mistrustful of.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But then someone told me the other day that, you know, I'm terrible with names. And the reason people use people's names is it's a technique to remember names.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I think the best way to look at Bear Grylls is compare and contrast with his nearest rival, Ray Mears. Now, Ray Mears is an overweight man that looks like he spends a lot of time in Kentucky Fried Chicken. And my favourite Ray Mears moment is in the middle of the Amazon jungle. He's with three lost villagers in the Amazon who almost barely speak English. They've never met anyone like him before. And Ray is asking them, how do you start fire? And they bring out a cigarette lighter, which is fantastic. And Ray Mears goes, okay. But then he starts trying to teach them their ancient method. And they're like, but we don't fucking need that.
Yeah, we've got a cigarette lighter.
So I don't know. Between those two, Ray Mears is equally odd. And I just think it's people that live in the wild are quite odd.
Yeah.
But I think Bear is a bit more savvy.
Well, I've heard from, you know, I've had proper SAS guys on
well,
here.
If you mention you're in the SAS, then you're not in the SAS, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Yeah. I've had some proper ones, although they have mentioned it, but I think it's documented. But
yeah.
They were like, oh, he was in the TA or something.
Of course he was. Yeah, he was in the reserves. Yeah, still, yeah.
But you know what?
But you know what?
Do what
he's
he
fitter,
did. He's
better
fit,
looking,
looks great with his top
richer
off.
Than us, so like, fucking good for
and
him.
You know what? He remembers your name and remembers what you do for a living.
Yeah.
You know,
so there you go.
Good on him.
Yeah. If someone asked me, like you, what city should I go that I haven't been to? Sarajevo. Have you been to Sarajevo?
No, but it's been on my list for a long, long time.
So I
really want... I can visualise it because...
It's incredible.
You know, the bridge and the war and everything you can...
But it's the war, but then it's also... My first memory in history classes were like the shot that started the First World War. And it was where Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot. And my favourite travel fact of all time, and this is absolutely true. So I got there... And the story of Archduke Franz Ferdinand is he turns up in Sarajevo. There are four assassins waiting for him along the quay, and he's being driven in a car. And basically the first guy chickens out. Second guy throws a bomb, and it bounces off the car and explodes, but underneath. So they drive him out of there. They get him to the town hall. He gives a speech, and then they're like, you know what? We've got to get you out of this town. So they're driving him out of the town, but instead of doing... In the original thing, he was going to go back and then a tour of the town, and no one had told the driver. And so the third or fourth assassin has really depressed. He knows he's screwed up. He's literally sitting at a cafe, and the driver takes the wrong turn, turns right, and then gets told he's got to take the wrong turn. So he stops right opposite this assassin, who just goes, fuck it, I've got to, and kills him. And I love that kind of weird... You know,
if
it was that chance sliding door stuff.
Yeah,
but the greatest fact, and I saw it on a photo and I couldn't believe it, is there's a picture of Franz Ferdinand's car just before it makes that turn. And I looked at the number plate and I was like, it can't be. And I looked again and I looked again and it absolutely is. And in the end, I had to be so sure the actual car is in a military museum in Vienna. So I went to Vienna to check. So what's the famous thing about Franz Ferdinand being shot? It started the First World War.
Yes.
What's the number plate of Franz Ferdinand's car?
Oh my God, I
11/11/18, which is the last day of the First World War. And I was like, no way, it
no
cannot be
way.
I've seen this shit on Facebook so many times, all these things can't be true. It's absolutely true, and that is the weirdest thing. And it is actually true.
I suppose there's so many conspiracy theories.
Everyone thinks photoshopped, all that shit, and then everyone's like, oh, it's Illuminati, they all knew it was gonna, but it's isn't that weird? I mean, that's just totally odd.
That is very weird.
So that's my favorite. But I love Sarajevo. If you've got nowhere else to go, like you can't think of anywhere to go, you can fly to somewhere like Split or Dubrovnik, and you've got lovely Croatia, and then you drive up through Bosnia-Herzegovina, you go through Mostar where the bridge was blown up and they've rebuilt it, and you end up in Sarajevo, which is literally where east meets west. You know, it's got minarets vying with church steeples. It's got this incredible history of the war recently, but also of past wars. And then it had the Winter Olympics there, so it's got an abandoned bobsleigh run above, which they've turned into a roller coaster. I mean, it's the most incredible town.
Oh, I'll have to put that on my list.
Yeah.
So the new book is out now.
It's called The Hezbollah Hiking Club, and it's basically my first proper travel book where I haven't... My other travel books have always been like lots of different trips. So Dark Tourist was 6 different trips. So was Scary Monsters. This one was my attempt to get a bit more grown up and do a full long story. And it's the fact that I grew up in Lebanon, but because the war happened when I was young, I never really saw all of Lebanon. My parents and my elders and brothers and sisters always used to travel around. And I found out about this thing called the Lebanon Mountain Trail, which is these Lebanese desperate to get tourists to Lebanon because no one goes there, and they should set up this 27-day walking trail from the Syrian border to the Israeli border. You can do it either way. And I thought, right, I've got to do it. So I got 2 friends who'd never been to the Middle East, and off we went. And we were totally unfit, and we really shouldn't have been doing it. But in the end, it was an amazing experience. And the book is about me going back to Lebanon, kind of facing quite a lot of demons, family-wise and stuff, but also just about how amazing Lebanon is. And it's also about growing old disgracefully with my friends. And I'm talking about it at the Cheltenham Literature Festival coming up on October the 7th, I think. And since I live in Cheltenham, I've just lived outside Cheltenham, and I've just bought a house in Cheltenham itself. So this is the first time that I'll actually walk to my gig at the Cheltenham Lit Festival, which I'm quite chuffed with.
Very nice. You can just stroll to work
that
evening.
Yeah.
And I hear it's a very good festival as well.
It is really good, actually, genuinely.
So we've got some listeners' questions for you.
Yeah.
Why
are you such a
No, not at all. My listeners are very nice.
Yeah.
Does your big mobile get switched to flight mode on trips?
Oh, God.
Has that followed you everywhere, that big mobile?
It doesn't. But actually, once I had to take it to America when I was filming in America with it, and it was just after 9/11, so it was an absolute nightmare because I basically had to explain. I mean, it's bad enough explaining to your in-laws, my wife's Canadian, you know, like, what does he actually do? He shouts into a big mobile. Well, that's his job. Like, so it was bad enough. But I had to take it into American, and they were so security conscious at the time. And so obviously they said, well, can you turn it on to prove it works? I said, no, it doesn't work. It's like, so they go, so you're just carrying a big cell. I go, look, please, this is my life. Yeah, just, and in the end, they kind of let me through. I think they felt so bad for me.
Not known for their sense of humour at customs
never.
In the States, are they?
Being a travel writer is the absolute worst thing for immigration. Like, immigration and travel writing are completely not at odds.
I always lie about the reason I'm there. So that was from Gabby. Anthony, Tony says, are you trigger happy?
No, I'm trigger unhappy. I'm an ex-goth. But I grew up in Beirut, so I'm very trigger happy. I do love guns.
You like a gun, do you?
I love guns, I just went, I mean, I really disapprove
of... It's not very, like, PC, is it?
Well, it's nothing to do with PC. I mean, I totally disapprove of the fact that you can
killing
wander around
people
with open carry, and I disagree with all Trump's guns policies, but I've just driven through Utah, and when I got to Nevada, I just took my kids and we went to a gun range and we fired all sorts of guns. We had a brilliant time. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go and shoot up a McDonald's. Well, not yet.
Well, that's good, actually, yeah. You never know if you have a bad day. You should do a TV programme about Trump and guns in America.
Oh, God, no, I couldn't. I'd be too angry.
Stuart Bailey says, which is the most quintessential English village in the Cotswolds? He says, Boughton-on-the-Water?
Boughton.
Yeah, Boughton.
Well, I mean, Boughton-on-the-Water's great. It's what we call a magnet. Basically, it's supposed to be the Venice.
We've had a lot of F words on the podcast.
Right.
We haven't heard any
C words. That, then.
No, I can.
Right.
I'll beep it out.
I mean, basically, those places are very useful because every Japanese tourist, every idiot tourist turns up there and goes there and leaves our villages alone. Boughton on the Water is called the Venice of the Cotswolds, which is, I mean, Birmingham's called the Venice of the Midlands.
Yeah,
so what
I've
does
heard
that mean?
That, yeah.
It's a very weird place. It's one of those weird places that has nothing real in it anymore. Everything is ye olde tea shoppies and stuff. And it's awful. But I've filmed something for every comedy show I've ever done in Boughton on the Water. I did the Morris
so
dancer
tweet
there. Well, no, because it's perfect British backdrop. And you just get this kind of revolving door of gullible tourists who will believe anything I say. So it's perfect.
So are you calling Japanese tourists?
I'm calling all tourists.
All tourists. Yeah. I like it. Emma, my friend Emma, actually, this is a very serious question. And it's a good question, actually.
Yeah.
She's the CEO of a wonderful charity that do heart operations. They're called Chain of Hope.
Right.
And they do heart operations for children in developing countries.
I don't like to talk about my charity.
Oh, well, she said, can you come to the Chain of Hope ball, which is a really fabulous ball.
Yeah, do I have to wear black tie?
People. I don't know. No, you get loads of rappers there and they're in their rap gear.
As long as I can rap, it's fine. I'd love to.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. She'd really like that. I always help out and look after the celebrities, so I'll be waiting on the door for you.
Oh, brilliant.
Simon Adams says, what is the most random location which someone has shouted to you, hello?
Okay, that's really good. I actually had it in North Korea. And I went to North Korea, and the only way you can get to North Korea is doing a coach tour, an organised coach tour with the government. And the irony of it is that the only people that want to go to North Korea are hardened backpackers whose idea of hell is a fucking coach tour. But actually, it's kind of fun because it's so awful. And we got to... We got taken to a bowling alley, which is one of the few human things in Pyongyang. And it was very weird. It was for high party officials. And as you went in, like everywhere, there was a gold bowling ball in a case. And apparently Kim Jong-il had turned up, just tried his hand and got perfect strikes all the way through.
As he would.
And I went in, and it wasn't the British ambassador, it was the Swedish ambassador was there, and the Swedish ambassador looked after British interests. And for some reason, trigger happy being big in Sweden. And I went in, and he goes, hello, I'm in North Korea, no one's shit. And I was like, oh, I'll have that. So that was great.
And it was a bit shit.
It was. No, I loved North Korea. Well, I mean, it was shit. It's shit if you live there, but
yes,
oh my God.
If you're visiting.
If you're a traveller, it's the place to go.
Unless you're that guy that took the poster and then...
Well, then you're an idiot. I was with a guy, he was a Finn, and he said he was a priest in the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monsters. You know that? He was a deliberate contrarian. They're these people who, basically, they take pictures of themselves with a colander on their head. They basically tried to get... They're so anti-religion that they tried to get their own made-up religion, which is Pastafarianism.
Right, I see what they did there.
To be made an official thing. Anyway, it's too boring to go in, but the guy was an idiot. And we went somewhere, we went to a museum, one of the few places you see old Korean artifacts. There was this beautiful old drum. He took his shoe off and started smacking the drum. So not only was that a massive offence shoe-wise, but it was that, and we nearly got lynched on the border zone. So yeah,
you do not do that.
No, you don't do that. I mean, he was beyond.
The poster guy got arrested and then died.
No, I'm surprised. Yeah. But he was. I think he had some Korean in him, which kind of gives them the excuse to. They're like, you're not really foreign.
I'm thinking of a really
Korean.
Bad joke.
I know. Do you want some? But yeah,
prison. Yeah.
But this guy was a Finn. Yeah.
Not very funny at all, really. But
that'll go.
My friend Rob Richards, he's a DJ in Brighton, says, "Can you talk, or are you in a library?" We were in a car,
Jesus
actually.
Jesus Christ, I'll never get over it. No, I'm in a library. Actually, I did a thing in the library recently in Brighton.
Rob's from Brighton.
Yeah,
well,
I know, that's why I did
it. Wow, this is such a strange coincidence.
But that's why I did it. So one of my... I did a new vamp Trigger Happy called Trigger Happy, not Trigger Happy TV, because it's TV is dead. And one of my favourite characters in that was Cycle Lane. So it was one of those people with just the camera on their helmet and basically just dealing with everywhere as a Cycle Lane, because that's what they do. And I went through Brighton Library... And the librarian in there said, "You can't cycle in here." I go, "This is a cycle lane." She goes, "What?" I go, "They've just put a cycle lane in." And she went, "Oh, I'm really sorry," and wandered off. So Brighton Library are very nice.
They're like the old Ramblers, aren't they?
No,
there's a pass through here.
Like, absolutely fine.
We are going to take it. Actually, talking about these things following you around, Alex George, who's the editor of this podcast, he will edit it for me.
Yeah.
He
good
said
luck with that,
Alex. Even though, yeah, good luck with that, Alex.
Try I'm finding a breath.
To him. Especially with our little observations out the window.
Yeah.
He said that even now he sends people video of the snail crossing the road.
See, that's better. The snail, I mean, Big
Is that
Mobile.
One of your favourites?
Big Mobile was just, it was just a thing, you know, and it was kind of the thing that everyone knew about, the Hensine Trigger Happy, but it bored the shit out of me. Big Snail, I love. That's one of my favourite sketches. And what I love about the Big Snail is, like, I think three nights before in the pub, I thought, snail, crossing the road, people will stop. And I was at a stage where I could just get someone to build a snail costume, and then we were doing it. But in England...
That's power, isn't it? That's
it was
real power.
But
like,
I also,
I
knew,
a big snail, I'm
I also
one.
Knew that in England, people would stop for a snail, whereas I always thought if I did that, just crawling across the road with all the traffic waiting, in America, four rednecks would have got out of a pickup truck and battered me to death as a Mexican snail. So, yeah, it was a very British joke.
Steve Plunkett says, "What was the worst reaction you've received to one of your trigger-happy pranks?"
Well, I nearly got beaten up by a nun. I was in Londis in Notting Hill, and the joke was... that I'd taken over the tannoy and I was dressed as a security guard. So when people came in, we'd go, "Bloke with red trousers, white top, he's over there in the groceries." And then I'd go around and just sort of stare at him as though he was shoplifting, and it would get awkward. And a nun walked in and we were all like, "Oh, should we, shouldn't we?" And I was like, "Come on, nun, comedy staple." So up it went, and I nodded, and he went, "Yeah, the nun's back. She's by the yogurts." So I go around the corner, and I start staring at the nun. I'm wearing these kind of mirrored shades. And she went utterly mental, and there was a big pile of baked bean cans. She started throwing them at me. She was fucking swearing and c***ing and all sorts of stuff at me, and then stormed out. And I'm still not sure whether she was a real sweary nun or a strippogram. I don't know. But,
or someone from a rival TV show, surely.
Possibly. But we were early then. There weren't any rival TV shows.
I know. Nuns can be quite violent. My dad used to get beaten up
by nuns.
Well,
nuns are violent.
Yeah,
I mean, we know that. I think it was just an angry nun.
When I grew up in Spain, a bit like you maybe growing up in Lebanon, we didn't have access to like popular culture, and we were desperate for any VHSs we got from England. So one of the things I had was a whole box set of Candid Camera.
Oh my God, so did I.
Really?
But that's where I started. I had two. I had Candid Camera, which was quite cool, actually.
Candid Camera was amazing.
It had some really surreal moments of it. And then I had one from South Africa called Funny People, which was really funny, but really racist, I now realise. So it was basically
was
like...
Was everything like damaging black people?
Well, no, it was just white boas taking the piss out of black people that were working for them. But the jokes were really funny. But it just... Now I realise the socio-economic dynamic. You know, it's terrible. It was funny, but it was wrong funny now.
It's
it was
a bit like you don't like Nazi experiments. Do you use
the jokes
come from it?
Well, I did use some of them, but I didn't do it in a bad way. And then I had Benny Hill as well, like in growing up in Lebanon.
I had Benny Hill as well.
We had Benny Hill, but Lebanese TV always had subtitles below in Arabic and French, and I speak Arabic and French, and both... Someone did the French subtitles, some did the Arabic subtitles. They were nothing to do with what was going on with Benny Hill. So there'll be times where people were laughing three times at three different jokes. I mean, I think the guy doing the Arabic subtitles was going for his own show. Like, it was totally different. And again, Benny Hill, totally wrong. Like,
Candid
what?
Camera, I don't remember people speaking about that. I don't know. Was it big?
Well, English Candid Camera was Jonathan Ruth, and it was okay, and then it got more and more smug. But the original Candid Camera, like, way back in America, I mean, that was the first time reality TV existed. It was the first time that an ordinary member of the public became the star. It was quite subversive in those days, and it was really surreal. The famous one ever was a guy who took the engine out of his car and then got in the car and rolled down the hill into a petrol station. This is like 1947, And he goes, something's wrong with the engine, can you have a look? Uh-huh. And the guy opens the engine, there's no engine. It's amazing, it's really simple, but it's good.
1947?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
I probably made that up, but
it's a long time ago.
It was black and white,
yeah.
It was ages ago.
I'm going to ask you my last question.
Yeah, go on. We've just arrived back at Oxford Parkway.
Arrived, which is,
see how
by
good
the way,
that is?
When I arrived here, because it's in the middle of nowhere and it's just a massive
you
car
thought this
park.
Was a prank, didn't you?
No, I knew, I did expect you to be dressed as a squirrel.
Yeah.
When I asked the guy, I said, is this the main entrance? He said, yes, to Oxford Parkway, like thinking that I'd been disappointed that I can't see any beautiful.
Oh, there must be so many Japanese tourists that get off here thinking, well, Oxford's not quite what it would have made out to me.
No, he actually thought that was me. Yeah. And I was like, it's okay, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Just, you know, it is a big car park in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. So while we're pulling into the car park, I'm going to ask you my last question, because my last question is always about music.
Oh, goody.
Because I think that music and travel go hand in hand.
Well, music's my big love, more than travel or comedy, so yeah.
I think I knew that, and I'm the same, so I'd love to be able to play music on the podcast.
Oh my God, so would I. Yeah, I know, that's what's so annoying.
But the last question is always about music, and actually you'd love, when John Simpson was on my podcast, you'd love his answer to this.
Go on.
Because he had the perfect answer. It was in, you know, it started out like something like, well, I was in a 1,000-year-old market in the centre of Baghdad and I found this old gramophone, and you're like, yes,
that's
exactly.
That's why he's BBC senior diplomatic correspondent, because set a fucking scene, all right?
Exactly.
I'm going to try and beat John Simpson.
Yeah, see if you can beat John Simpson. So my question is, if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what would that song be and where were you?
Oh, I'm going to beat John Simpson, I think.
Oh, are you? Brilliant. Yeah.
So growing up, my dad was old school, and he really didn't like pop music at all. The only thing I remember him sort of allowing us to play was Simon and Garfunkel, Sound of Silence and stuff. But in the car, we had a Range Rover, because we used to get, like, the very early Range Rover, because it was like a Land Rover, and we'd go off into the Syrian desert. And the one thing he had in it that was quite cool was an 8-track, those things you kind of slammed in like big cartridges. But you couldn't get many 8-tracks, so he had his opera and stuff like that. But for some reason, we had Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here. And so he kind of accepted it, and because there's a sort of element of classical to some Pink Floyd, it was very weird. He's like, I hate pop music, but we'd always go on these expeditions and we'd be listening to Shine On You Crazy Diamond and stuff. And when I went and did my first travel show, my first TV travel show, it was a show for Sky. It was called Excellent Adventure. And they said, go and recreate something you always wanted to do. And I kind of went and did this journey that I used to do when I was a kid. And we left Beirut and we drove on a road trip into Syria just before the whole civil war kicked off. And we ended up outside Palmyra and there were these caves where I remember we always used to camp, and I'd written my name in a cave, and I wanted to try and find that, because it really took me back. It was the first time I'd done an expedition on my own. And we ended up camping under these caves about 10 miles outside Palmyra. And at night, it was amazing. We lit a fire, and we were on our own in the middle of the Syrian desert, and it was this incredible, like, full moon, and it was amazing. And we had the car, so we just opened the car, and I had my iPod that I plugged into the car, and just Wish You Were Here reminded me so much of Syria anyway, and so I put it full on the car, and I just sat there in the middle of the Syrian desert thinking, I've got a TV show, I've been brought to Syria, and it was this moon, and honestly, it was so, like, spine-chilling for me, and we sat there, and it was the greatest moment of my life was that. So beat that, John Simpson. But he probably did, but it was.
Beat that,
John. So it was Wish You Were Here in the middle of the Syrian desert.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for that, and thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
I loved our little tour around Oxford, Dom. Thank you so much. And you can catch Dom at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, so don't miss it. Next week, we're in Madrid having tapas with Spain travel and food expert James Blick.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.